A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one on the eve of Shavuot. It's the harvest festival, the day the first barley sheaf was offered at the temple, and he's asking us to look beyond barley to the grains that actually sustain hundreds of millions of people today, but barely register in a Western supermarket. Millet, sorghum, teff, fonio, the forgotten grains. How many people are hungry right now? Do we actually not produce enough food? And when Westerners draft their own dietary assumptions onto cultures they've never encountered, where do we trip? It's a big one.
It is, and the Shavuot connection is genuinely useful here, not just a seasonal hook. Shavuot marks the wheat harvest in ancient Israel, but the Omer offering that counted down to it, that was barley. Barley was the poor man's grain, the subsistence crop. And that's exactly what millet, sorghum, and teff are for about 500 million people today. So let's start with the numbers, because the scale of global hunger is both staggering and completely counterintuitive. 733 million people faced hunger in 2025. That's from the UN State of Food Security report released just last month, April 2026. The number hasn't budged since 2020. 733 million, that's 1 in 11 people on the planet.
Hunger here means what exactly? Because I feel like that word gets stretched.
It's a specific FAO definition. Chronic undernourishment, meaning a person doesn't have enough dietary energy to maintain a normal, active, healthy life. It's not, I skip breakfast, it's a sustained calorie deficit. And the regional breakdown tells its own story. 282 million in Africa, that's 20.4% of the continent's population. 418 million in Asia, 43 million in Latin America and the Caribbean. And here's the thing that should really land. 70% of the world's hungry live in conflict, affected fragile states. That's World Food Program data. Hunger is increasingly concentrated in war zones.
It's not a production problem.
It is absolutely not a production problem. Global cereal production hit 2.8 billion metric tons in 2025. That's USDA data, the WASD report. If you do the math, that's about 2,800 calories per person per day before you even account for pulses, vegetables, fruit, fish, dairy. We produce enough calories to feed 10 billion people.
Yet, 1 in 11 goes hungry. So the food exists. It's just not reaching them.
And some of it isn't reaching anyone. 30 to 40% of all food produced globally is lost or wasted. In sub-Saharan Africa, post-harvest loss for grains specifically is 15 to 20%, poor storage, pests, lack of infrastructure. Grain gets harvested, piled in open-air structures, and the rats and the mold get to it before a truck ever shows up. In the developed world, the waste happens at the consumer end, the bag of spinach in the back of the fridge. In the developing world, it happens between the field and the market.
We've got enough food. We're just bad at moving it and keeping it. And that's before we even get to the question of what food we're producing and who it's for. Which brings us to the grains themselves. Herman, tell me about millet.
Millet is not one thing. It's a family of small-seeded grasses. Pearl millet, finger millet, proso millet, foxtail millet, koto millet, little millet, barnyard millet. Pearl millet is the big one in Africa and the Sahel. It is the sixth most produced cereal on the planet, about 30 million tons a year, and yet it receives less than 2% of global agricultural research and development funding. That's CGIAR data from 2024. For a grain that feeds hundreds of millions of people.
What does rice get?
Rice gets about 40% of cereal R&D funding. And I want to be clear, rice is incredibly important, I'm not here to trash rice. But the funding disparity reflects a deeper assumption about whose food matters. Millet is what economists and agronomists call an orphan crop, a crop that's critical to food security in specific regions but gets ignored by global research because it's not traded on commodity exchanges, the way wheat, maize, and rice are.
That's a bleak phrase.
It's not just millet. Sorghum. 60 million tons a year, the fifth most produced cereal globally. But in the United States, most of it goes to animal feed and ethanol. In China, it's biofuel. Teff, the staple grain of Ethiopia, the basis of injera, that spongy flatbread, grown on about 3 million hectares in the Horn of Africa. Fonio, West Africa's ancient grain, matures in 6 to 8 weeks, so drought-resistant it's sometimes called the lazy farmer's crop, because it practically grows itself. Amaranth, a pseudo-cereal that was a staple of the Aztec Empire before the Spanish banned it for being used in pagan rituals.
The Spanish banned a grain?
Amaranth was central to Aztec religious ceremonies. They'd mix it with honey and form it into idols. The conquistadors saw that and said, "This grain is demonic. You're growing wheat now." And amaranth cultivation collapsed.
There's a long history of powerful people deciding which grains are legitimate and which aren't.
It continues today. Here's what makes these grains important for food security, beyond the cultural dimension. Pearl millet can grow in as little as 250 millimeters of annual rainfall. Rice needs 1200 millimeters minimum. Wheat needs about 500 to 700. Maize needs at least 500. Pearl millet will produce a harvest in conditions where wheat doesn't even germinate.
250 millimeters. Barely any rain.
It's semi-arid. It's the Sahel. And these grains aren't just drought-tolerant, they're nutrient-dense in ways that rice and wheat are not. Finger millet has 5 to 7 times the calcium of rice, 3 times the fiber of wheat. Teff is naturally high in iron and resistive starch. Fonio has a balanced amino acid profile that includes methionine and cysteine, which most grains lack.
They're tougher to grow in bad conditions, and they're better for you. Why aren't they everywhere?
That is the question that the whole episode pivots on. And part of the answer is that being tough to grow is different from being easy to process. Millet and sorghum have hard outer bran layers that require de-hulling. They have short shelf lives once milled. They're labor-intensive to process at scale. The global food system is optimized for wheat, maize, and rice because we've spent a century building mills, silos, shipping routes, and futures markets around those three grains. The infrastructure doesn't exist for millet at the same scale.
It's a chicken and egg problem. No infrastructure because no market demand. No market demand because no infrastructure.
That's where we get into the second big question from the prompt. If we really wanted to solve world hunger, could we? The answer is yes, technically. We have the calories, we have the logistics technology, we have the agronomic knowledge. But the yes comes with a but the size of a continent. The but is political will, trade policies, and the fact that hunger is concentrated in places where governance has collapsed.
You can't ship millet to a war zone if the trucks get looted at the checkpoint.
The World Food Program spends about 40% of its budget on security, armed escorts, negotiations with armed groups, risk insurance. In South Sudan, in parts of Somalia, in eastern DRC, the food exists in warehouses 200 kilometers away and it cannot get through. That's not a production problem. That's not even a distribution problem in the logistical sense. It's a security problem.
The could we solve it question is almost misleading. Technically, yes. Practically, no. Not without solving conflict first. But there's another layer here that the prompt gets at. The assumptions Westerners bring when they try to help. What do we get wrong?
Let me give you 3 specific trip points. The first one, protein centrism. Western food aid, especially from the U.S., and I say this as someone who generally supports American foreign policy, has historically been shaped by the assumption that the world needs more protein and more calories in the most shelf-stable form possible. So we ship fortified wheat flour and soy protein isolate to regions where people don't eat bread, where they may not have ovens, where the cooking fuel to boil wheat porridge might cost more than the food itself.
We ship ingredients they can't cook.
Or won't. A 60-year-old woman in rural Niger has been eating millet porridge her entire life. Her gut microbiome is adapted to it. Her cooking techniques are built around it. Her social rituals involve pounding millet with other women. You hand her a bag of fortified wheat flour and say, "This is better for you." She might not have a way to cook it, she might not like the taste, and she might sell it at the market to buy millet she actually wants.
Then there's the dignity piece. Food isn't just fuel.
It's not. Which brings me to the second trip point, the superfood problem. Quinoa is the classic case. Quinoa was a staple of the Andean diet for thousands of years. Then, around 2006, Western health food markets discovered it. Prices tripled between 2006 and 2014. Bolivian and Peruvian farmers could suddenly sell their quinoa for export prices that were higher than what their neighbors could afford. Local consumption dropped. The people who had grown and eaten quinoa for millennia were priced out of their own staple.
The health food aisle in Whole Foods literally took food out of the mouths of Andean farmers.
To be clear, quinoa exports did bring income to some farming communities. It's not a simple villain story. But the net effect on food security for non-farming Andean households was negative. The FAO documented this extensively, and the quinoa boom created monoculture pressure. Farmers stopped rotating crops, soil degraded, and when quinoa prices eventually dropped, they were left with depleted land and no diversified income.
The Western consumer discovering a grain can be an extractive act, even when the intention is just, I'd like a healthy lunch bowl.
The road to nutritional hell is paved with good intentions. Third trip point, monoculture thinking in aid policy. USAID's Feed the Future program, launched under Obama and continued in various forms since, historically pushed maize and rice intensification in Africa. High-yield hybrid seeds, synthetic fertilizer, the Green Revolution playbook. And to be fair, that playbook worked in India and Mexico in the 1960s and 70s. But it also assumed that what Africa needed was more maize and more rice.
Instead of more millet and sorghum that actually grow there.
Here's a concrete example. The 2024 to 2025 El Niño-driven drought in southern Africa. Malawi lost 40% of its maize crop. In the same region, sorghum and millet fields lost only 10 to 15%. They survived because they're adapted to exactly that kind of stress. And yet, 90% of the emergency food aid that poured into Malawi was maize meal.
Wait, 90%? They ship maize to a country whose maize crop had just failed because of drought. A drought that millet survived. And they didn't ship millet.
They shipped maize. Because that's what the aid procurement pipeline is set up to do. The U.S. produces enormous amounts of maize. It's cheap, it's available, and the legal framework for food aid. The Farm Bill, the Food for Peace Act, has historically required that a significant portion of U.S. food aid be sourced from American farmers and shipped on American vessels. It's not just an aid program. It's also an agricultural subsidy program and a maritime jobs program.
Food aid is partly about feeding hungry people, and partly about keeping American farmers and shippers employed.
That's the uncomfortable reality. The good news is, this has been changing. The 2018 Farm Bill increased the amount of aid that can be sourced locally, cash transfers that let the WFP buy food in the region rather than shipping it from Kansas. Local and regional procurement has gone from about 10% to as high as 40% in some WFP operations. But it's still not the default.
When you ship imported grain instead of buying local, you're not just feeding people, you're reshaping an entire food system. Tell me about what happens in the Sahel when NGOs dump rice.
There was a 2022 study in the journal Global Food Security that found 60% of food aid in the Sahel is white rice. White rice cannot be grown in the Sahel. It requires irrigation infrastructure that doesn't exist. So every bag of rice creates dependency. It tells local farmers, don't bother growing millet, we'll bring rice. It tells local consumers, rice is what civilized people eat. Millet is for the backward. And it tells local governments, you don't need to invest in millet processing infrastructure, the donors will handle food.
There's a cultural erasure happening alongside the nutritional one.
In Burkina Faso, Fonio is called the seed of the ancestors. It's central to harvest rituals, wedding feasts, naming ceremonies. When you displace Fonio with imported rice, you're not just changing what people eat. You're severing a connection between food, land, and identity that goes back centuries. But it doesn't have a global commodity market behind it.
What does work? Because this has been a fairly grim tour so far. Give me the success stories.
There are real ones, and they're instructive. Let's start with India's millet revival. In 2023, the Indian government declared millets, nutri-cereals, and launched a $500 million subsidy program to boost production and marketing. They branded it around health and climate resilience. Consumption is still only about 8 kilograms per person per year compared to 70 kilograms for rice, so there's a long way to go. But production has increased, processing facilities are being built, and millet is showing up in urban supermarkets in Delhi and Mumbai as a premium health food.
India making millet aspirational.
And it's working because they didn't frame it as poor people's food that we're giving to hungry people. They framed it as an ancient super grain that modern health-conscious consumers should choose. Different psychology, same grain.
What about Africa?
The African Orphan Crops Consortium, launched in 2011, based in Nairobi, is sequencing the genomes of 101 underutilized African crops. Baobab, moringa, amaranth, fonio, teff, dozens of indigenous vegetables and fruits. The idea is that if you understand the genetics, you can breed for better yields, better taste, better processing characteristics, without losing the traits that make these crops resilient in the first place.
The Gates Foundation is involved?
$40 million into sorghum and millet breeding from 2021 to 2026. They've produced drought-tolerant varieties with 20 to 30% higher yields. Not through genetic modification, through marker-assisted breeding, which is basically accelerated traditional breeding. You identify the genes for drought tolerance, you cross plants that have them, and you select the best offspring. It's faster than waiting for nature, but it's not GMO.
The yields are actually better?
20 to 30% in field trials across Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. But here's the thing, and this is where the episode plan really sharpens. The bottleneck isn't seed genetics, it's post-harvest processing. Millet and sorghum are hard to mill. They have short shelf lives. They require labor-intensive dehulling. You can give a farmer a drought-tolerant millet variety that produces 30% more grain, and if she has nowhere to store it and no way to mill it, half of that gain rots or gets eaten by pests.
The most impactful intervention might be a $2 bag.
You're referencing the Purdue Improved Crop Storage Bags, hermetic storage bags that seal grain in an airtight environment. Insects inside the grain use up the oxygen and die. The grain stays dry. Post-harvest loss drops by 90%. They cost about $2 each and last for 3 to 5 years. In field trials across West Africa, farmers using these bags reduced their grain losses from 15 to 20% down to less than 2%. That is a higher return on investment than any new seed variety.
A $2 plastic bag outperforms a $40 million breeding program.
They do different things. Both are needed. But from a pure cost-effectiveness standpoint, storage and processing infrastructure consistently beats seed genetics in the development economics literature. The Odisha Millet Mission in India. This ran from 2017 to the present. Didn't just distribute seeds. It built processing units in villages. It trained women self-help groups to run dehulling machines. It created marketing links to urban buyers. And the result was 50,000 hectares restored to millet cultivation and a 40% increase in farmer incomes.
40% income increase from a processing and markets approach.
That's the lesson. The grains exist. The calories exist. The drought tolerance is already in the DNA of these plants. What's missing is the infrastructure to get the grain from the field to the plate in a form people want to eat, and the market signals that tell farmers planting millet is a good economic decision.
Which brings us to the Western consumer piece. The prompt asks about what we can actually do. And I think a lot of listeners hear global hunger and either feel guilty or tune out because it seems unsolvable.
The single most impactful thing a Western consumer can do is diversify their own grain consumption. Not as charity, not as a sacrificial act, but to create market demand that normalizes these crops. If fonio and millet become mainstream in Europe and North America, not as a niche health food for yoga instructors, but as a normal thing you might cook for dinner, that drives investment in processing infrastructure. Mills get built. Supply chains form. And those supply chains benefit producers in the Sahel and South Asia because they create a commercial market that doesn't depend on aid budgets.
Buying millet at the grocery store is actually a form of food system advocacy.
It's more effective than signing a petition because it sends a price signal. And commodity markets respond to price signals faster than they respond to moral arguments. The fonio revival in West Africa is instructive here. Chefs like Pierre Thiam, a Senegalese chef based in New York, have brought fonio to U.S. markets through his company, Yolele. But only about 5% of fonio production is exported. The rest stays local. And the export boom hasn't caused price spikes because production increased threefold since 2018. They scaled supply alongside demand.
It's possible to do the quinoa thing right, if you're intentional about it.
The key difference is that fonio production was expanded, not just redirected from local markets to export markets. That requires investment in farmer training, in processing facilities, in market linkages. It's harder than just showing up with a checkbook and buying the existing harvest, but it's the difference between extractive trade and sustainable development.
Let's talk about what policymakers and aid organizations should be doing differently. You mentioned local procurement earlier.
The Food Sovereignty Framework. This comes from La Via Campesina. The global peasant movement argues that aid should prioritize local procurement and storage infrastructure over imported grain. The WFP's Purchase for Progress program, P4P, demonstrated that this is viable. It increased local sourcing from about 10% to 40% in participating countries. Farmers got a reliable buyer. Hungry people got culturally appropriate food. Money stayed in the local economy.
Except the American shipping companies.
That's the political obstacle. Food aid reform in the U.S. is opposed by a coalition of shipping interests, agribusiness, and some NGOs whose funding models depend on monetizing donated commodities. Monetization, by the way, is when an NGO receives free American grain, sells it on the local market to raise cash for their programs, and in the process, crashes local grain prices and undercuts local farmers. It's a terrible practice, and has been widely documented as harmful.
An NGO gets free grain, sells it cheap, and destroys the market for the local farmers they're supposedly helping.
That's monetization, and it's been largely phased out in official U.S. food aid. The 2018 Farm Bill restricted it, but it persists in some NGO practices and in other donor countries' programs.
That's the Western assumption problem in its purest form. We have grain, you need grain, here's grain, without asking whether you want grain, what kind of grain, or what the grain will do to your local grain market.
It circles back to the cultural dimension. In many of these regions, grain isn't just calories, it's identity. In Ethiopia, teff is the basis of injera, that spongy, slightly sour flatbread that's the foundation of every meal. An Ethiopian meal without injera isn't an Ethiopian meal. You can't replace teff with wheat flour and expect people to be happy about it, even if the calories are the same.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. That's what imported wheat flour is to someone who grew up eating injera.
And we haven't even touched on amaranth. The Aztecs grew it, the Spanish banned it, and it survived in remote pockets of Mexico and Guatemala for 500 years. Now it's being rediscovered, not just as a health food in the West, but as a climate-resilient crop for Central America. Amaranth can grow in poor soils with minimal water. Its leaves are edible too. It's a dual-purpose crop. And it produces these tiny seeds that are about 14% protein with a complete amino acid profile.
Complete protein from a plant. That's unusual.
Most plant proteins are deficient in one or more essential amino acids. Amaranth and quinoa are the exceptions. They're complete proteins, which means they're not just culturally significant, they're nutritionally superior to wheat and rice in measurable ways. And yet amaranth is grown on maybe 200,000 hectares globally. Wheat is on 220 million hectares.
Three orders of magnitude difference.
That's not because wheat is three orders of magnitude better. It's because wheat has had a century of aggressive breeding, mechanization, and market development behind it. The Green Revolution was built on wheat, rice, and maize. Norman Borlaug won the Nobel Peace Prize for dwarf wheat, and the Green Revolution saved millions of lives. I'm not diminishing that. But the next Green Revolution, the one we need for a warming planet, is going to have to be built on different crops.
Because wheat can't handle 3 degrees of warming.
Wheat yields drop about 6% for every degree Celsius of warming above the optimum. At 2 degrees of warming, which we're on track for, that's 12% yield loss globally. At 3 degrees, 18%. And the losses are concentrated in the hottest regions, which are also the poorest. Meanwhile, pearl millet barely notices 2 degrees. It evolved in the Sahel. It's already adapted to temperatures that would kill wheat.
The climate case for forgotten grains is essentially, these are the crops that will survive. Everything else is a bet on a climate that no longer exists.
That's the open question the prompt leaves us with. As climate change accelerates, will the global food system finally pivot toward the drought-tolerant grains that have been feeding millions for millennia? Or will we keep trying to grow wheat in the Sahel?
The next 10 years are going to be a battle between two visions. The climate-smart agriculture push, which often means GMO maize, drip irrigation, and more inputs, and the agroecological approach, which centers indigenous crops and traditional knowledge.
The data suggests both are needed. There's no purest solution here. Some regions will benefit from improved maize varieties. Others need millet processing infrastructure. The mistake is assuming one model fits everywhere. Which is, ironically, the same Western assumption trap we've been talking about this whole episode.
The monoculture of the mind, applied to agriculture policy.
That's well put. Let me give you one more concrete example before we wrap. In the 2024 growing season, Niger experienced a 40% rainfall deficit, a serious drought. Maize yields dropped 35% in the affected regions. Pearl millet yields dropped 12%. Same drought, same soil, different crops. And Niger's farmers know this. They're not planting millet because they don't know about maize. They're planting millet because millet works.
Yet the Global Agricultural Research Establishment still treats millet like a hobby crop.
Less than 2% of R&D funding. For the sixth most produced cereal on Earth. That number should be seared into people's minds. It's not a funding gap, it's a value judgment about whose food system matters.
Let's get practical for the listeners. What can someone who's convinced by this actually do?
First, diversify your own pantry. Buy millet, buy fonio, buy sorghum flour, cook with them. The more these grains show up in Western kitchens, the more viable the commercial supply chains become. Second, if you're in a position to influence institutional purchasing, you run a restaurant, you're on a school board, you work in corporate catering, specify these grains. The demand signal from institutional buyers is enormous. Third, support organizations that are doing the processing infrastructure work, not just shipping grain. The African Orphan Crops Consortium, the Odisha Millet Mission Model, the Hermetic Storage Bag Distribution Programs. Those are the interventions that actually change food systems rather than just moving calories around.
If you're a policymaker or work in the aid sector, stop shipping staple grains that can't be grown locally. The evidence on this is overwhelming. Local procurement works better, costs less, and doesn't destroy local markets.
The WFP's own data shows that local procurement is cheaper per calorie delivered than transoceanic shipping in most cases. It's faster, days instead of months. And it builds the local agricultural economy rather than undermining it. The only reason it's not standard practice is politics.
Politics and inertia. The two great enemies of common sense.
Which brings us back to Shavuot. The holiday is about the first fruits, the beginning of the harvest. It's a moment to take stock of what the land has produced and to offer the best of it, and the Omer offering that leads up to Shavuot. That was barley, the subsistence grain, the grain of the poor. The Torah didn't say, bring your finest wheat and we'll talk. It said, bring the barley.
There's something profound in that. The harvest festival begins with the grain that everyone can grow, not the grain that only the wealthy can afford.
Maybe the harvest we need to start valuing is the one that includes every grain, not just the ones that fit on a supermarket shelf. 733 million people are hungry on a planet that produces enough food for 10 billion. That's not a farming problem. It's a priorities problem.
The calories exist. The grains exist. The knowledge exists. What's missing is the will to value what's already growing.
The humility to ask what people actually want to eat before we ship them our assumptions in a 50-pound bag. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, geologists surveying the granitic pegmatites of the Seychelles discovered that certain feldspar crystals fluoresce in intense electric blue under shortwave ultraviolet light, a property caused by trace europium ions substituting for calcium in the crystal lattice. The effect is so vivid that local prospectors briefly used portable UV lamps to map pegmatite veins at night.
Prospectors chasing glowing rocks on tropical islands in the dark. That's a movie someone should have made.
I'd watch it. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who still thinks quinoa is just a grain. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. It's something
find your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear hoes. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.